Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Greetings, comrades. Thank you for tuning in to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And you listeners can all rejoice, because our beloved Gabe Haggard is back in the co-pilot seat.
Thank you, Pauline. I just wanted to start off today by telling a story that will be interesting to no one. And that is that I am very much overjoyed by the close proximity of this top-secret, undisclosed location in which we are recording this podcast, and my apartment. I got in my car and turned on the radio, and Guns N' Roses, Paradise City was just beginning. Mm-hmm. By the time it was over, I was here.
I don't think you would do it if it were any further away.
It's right on the cusp.
Yeah.
It's right there.
And as if that wasn't enough cause for celebration, I'm also very pleased to announce that our friend, Jeff Ashkin, is making another appearance on our show today. In case you missed it, Jeff last appeared on our Vertigo episode. So if you haven't already given that one a listen, check it out after you're done with this episode. It's available for download on our show page, flixwise.com. Jeff, you want to say hi?
Hey, everybody. Thank you. I also enjoyed being at this undisclosed location. Thought the blindfold was a little unnecessary, but glad to be here.
It's for your own good.
I figured. Okay.
As you know, every week on the podcast, we discuss one movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. On today's episode, we'll be piecing together the number 8 movie on the greatest films of all time list, Ziga Vertov's Man with a Movie Camera. Man with a Movie Camera is the first documentary on our list. So, to mark the occasion, we're going to talk about our favorite documentaries. Then we'll finish off with a final note of positivity. All right, we've got another silent film on our hands, boys. You guys ready?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Good. Because in Soviet Russia, film projects you. Sorry, that's probably the lamest joke I've ever told, but I couldn't help it.
I thought of a better joke for the silent film.
So okay, intro, do it.
Okay, so ask me if I'm ready.
Are you guys ready?
See, because I didn't say anything because it's a silent film.
Caddies, return.
The next film on the Sight and Sound Critics poll is Ziga Vertov's 1929 classic film / experiment, Man with a Movie Camera. The film opens with a preamble, which reads as follows. The film, Man with a Movie Camera, represents an experimentation in the cinematic communication of visual phenomena, without the use of intertitles, without the help of a scenario, without the help of theater, a film without actors, without sets, etc. This new experimentation work by Kino Ai is directed towards the creation of an authentically international absolute language of cinema, absolute kinography. On the basis of its complete separation from the language of theater and literature. So given that there's no scenario here, I'm going to keep my overview nice and brief. Basically, Ziga Vertov set out to make a movie depicting a single day in a major Soviet city. So over the course of 3 years, he filmed every inch of several different cities, including Odessa, Kiev, and Moscow. He filmed each place from every conceivable camera angle. He takes us from sunrise to sunset. There is work and there is leisure. There are the rich and there are the poor. Ziga captures both the mundane and the extraordinary. Life ends, life begins, and life goes on as scheduled. In addition to the day in the life elements, there is also a meta-documentary within the film which depicts the shooting, the editing, and the eventual premiere of the film. All right, guys, your turn. What did you guys make of Man with a Movie Camera? Did you like it? I guess we'll start with Gabe.
Yeah, I did enjoy this film.
Okay.
I liked it a lot. I thought it was just what it like set out to be. What I imagined is like a child with a new toy, mm-hmm. like setting out to discover like what it can do.
Yeah,
that's really the feeling that I got.
Yeah, I have to agree with Gabe on this. I thought it was a great film. I thought that what was so great about it was the inventiveness with all the shots. Like, it really gave you a sense of time and place. I mean, there was no real narrative there, but you really get a sense of being in those locations and in 1929. But it was definitely like thrilling. There's a certain joy to it, you know, where you can put the camera here, you can put the camera here, you know. And I think at that time for people to watch, be like, oh, wow, this is probably very inspiring to people to see that they can, you know, put a camera anyway. It doesn't have to be static and, you know, stationary and watch the action. It can be here. It can be there. It can be this point of view or that point of view. And obviously, you know, we're still talking about it, which is amazing. But for that time to see that happen, I think it must have been really inspiring. So
it's also a really interesting historical document. I think, Jeff, you touched on this a little bit. I mean, I think Vertov made a point of saying, this is, I'm going to depict real life, real people. And I think that was probably really novel for people back then. And it makes for a really interesting historical document for us as viewers in the 21st century. So I wanted to ask you guys, what makes this a documentary?
Well, I would say for me, it's about, you know, a time and a place and an establishment of what was going on at that time. And one of the most obvious reasons is there are no actors in the film. And I mean, I'm curious because there's that one moment, it's so brief, but this one guy's like laying down and he scratches himself and he looks at the camera and he has like this smile on his face, like as if they caught him off guard and he wasn't sure how to deal with it. And I love that little moment because it felt like they really discovered this guy just hanging out and they, you know, put the camera on him. But so it feels like you're watching real people going about their lives and, you know, what was going on at the time. You know, obviously not too in-depth, but enough to make it give you a sense of time and place.
So you don't feel that the large naked people at the beach were models?
Speaking of naked people, I think in the beginning when she's getting dressed, I think that had to have been staged. Or maybe not. Maybe that was just his wife and she's like, oh, Zigga. Yeah. Do you really have to film this?
And I was watching you can't see her face often.
That's true.
And so I felt like at the very least they were able for the most part to preserve the idea that it was not staged.
Exactly, yeah.
In there. And there was only, I think, one shot in the film that stood out to me that they used twice. It was a reaction of a boy, and they used it the first time. He's looking at the street performer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they use it again later in the film. I don't remember what he's watching that time, but they used the same shot, and it was not jarring, you know, but I noticed it and I was like, oh, they really shouldn't have done that, you know, because they're trying to, obviously they're splicing things together and like, you know, but then it gave me doubt, you know, for the rest of the film. Like, wait a minute, how authentic is this?
You know? See, that's the thing. Like, you know, to clarify, I should say that obviously things had to be set up to get a good shot, really. But what did they probably tell the person? It's like, oh, we're going to put this in this experimental documentary.
Right.
You know what I mean? They probably didn't say, like, the story of your... You know, I mean, that there weren't any actors there.
Right.
So that's what I feel like comes in documentary.
Right. It's interesting. I wonder, the large naked people on the beach you speak of, like, did they realize they would be immortalized in this classic film for the rest of eternity forever, however long the film lasts?
I've been on beaches here in Southern California where... Not to be racist, but a group of Europeans will walk up change.
You know.
And will walk up and start changing on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was watching this film, that's what it reminded me of. Mm-hmm. They're like, what? We're at the beach. We're going to change.
That's racist, Gib.
See, I think at that time, though, there's no IMDb. If you were on a film and you maybe not hacked to a movie theater, you might not even know. You know what I mean?
Right,
what they were going to
be
showing?
What are you doing? What is that box?
Yeah, they may have never even seen it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's just funny to think about.
Yeah.
But
now it's the eighth greatest film of all time.
Exactly.
Yeah, just keep that in mind when someone's like, with their GoPro, next time you're going for a hike and they're running up with a GoPro on their helmet,
next
you know?
Next time I'm changing in public.
Yeah.
I'm like, ah.
Careful.
You never know.
This might be in the top 10 greatest films of all time. And rightly so.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Absolutely. Yeah, no. Maybe you should change publicly more often, you know.
People can see he's changing right now.
Yeah. This devolved quickly.
This is a family program. Let's continue.
Anyway. So my thought, as far as it being a documentary, it seemed to me like he, not only was he trying to depict real life, he was trying to make a point more than to impart any, you know, information. it was more to try and make a point about cinema itself and movies themselves, you know?
And that's where, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but to go back to like the analogy of a child, that's what it looked like to me. He was doing like, look what I can do. Look what I can do. You know, and it was really cool and really impressive.
Right.
But that's what, you know, he's going around, you know, shoot with this camera, shooting all these different angles. And, you know, then there are shots of, like, from the angle, from underneath the train. And then there are shots of the guy digging a hole
right.
underneath the train, you know. And so there's shots of the shot and shots of getting the shot, you know. And shots of the lens focusing, you know. And so... I think the whole thing was like, hey, everybody, look what we can do. Look what I can do with the camera.
Right.
And that has resonated, you know, throughout the century.
Right.
Yeah, you can definitely see the influences of this film in other films. I feel like right now filmmakers use the techniques that Vertov brought up in his film and marry it to a narrative most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like most people don't go see experimental films, certainly not experimental documentaries, but... The techniques have been adopted so much that it's just incredible because we probably have subconsciously adopted them ourselves without realizing it.
Yeah. It does kind of feel like a kid with a toy, in particularly with regard to the special effects. Like, we know now pretty much how he did that. But I wonder, do you think that they hold up? Are they still cool to look at? Like, the stop motion, the superimpositions...
I mean, cool might be a stretch. I don't know. But again, it's the same thing. It's to see the invention of these techniques is really cool and really impressive to watch. The one that I felt that felt the most like stilted to me was like the stop, the freeze frames that they were doing. That felt a little silly. The stop motion was just kind of like cute,
the
you know?
Crayfish that can move itself.
Yeah, but the slow motion. I when I was watching the slow motion, I felt at that moment I was the most, you know, transported back to 1929 in the theater watching this and just going like, just with my mind just being blown, you know, by how cool that was. You know, and also that is still the exact same thing that we do today.
Exactly.
You know, and it's just, it's so, yeah, it does hold up. It's flawless. It's beautiful.
I agree with that, but also, I like the stop motion. I don't know. I'm going to say it. I'm a big fan of stop motion. I feel like it doesn't get used a lot anymore because of CGI, but it has a nice charm to it, you know. And,
I think so too. You know, yeah. So. Those of you who have been on our website will recognize the Eye Through the Lens is from Man with a Movie Camera. And I think it is just as unsettling in the movie as it is on our website.
I like that shot. Yeah. I think it's cool.
Yeah. I think a lot of the images are still gorgeous. So the film explicitly says there is no scenario. But what do you think the meaning of the film was? Did you find yourself trying to place a narrative on it or?
Well, for me, I think that it is exactly what it says it is. It's a document about how to put the camera anywhere you want. It's a document about what's going on, what was going on in that time, in that place.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's like he's showing us that we can do whatever we want, but he's doing it in a very deliberate, very artistic, very creative, and very engaging way.
Interesting. I mean, so he's always calling attention to the fact that this is a movie. He doesn't seem to want the audience to forget that. I was struck by the juxtaposition of the filmmaking process, particularly the editing process. And we should note that it was actually Vertov's wife who was the editor. But so it was the juxtaposition of the factory workers and industrialization with the filmmaking. So I'm wondering if he wanted to make some sort of parallel between those two, that both filmmaking and factories are the product of a lot of labor. Jeff's looking at me like I'm crazy.
No, I'm trying to think that if I made that connection, I don't think.
I am willing to admit that I did not. I noticed that sort of stuff, and now that you bring it back to my mind, like, oh, yeah, there were, like, he was intercutting this with that, just the way, same way he intercut, you know, a blinking face with shutters, the hosing down the sidewalk with bathing, you know. So certainly, I'm certainly willing to concede that he may very well have been doing that.
Plus, there were a lot of shots in this movie. And there were a lot of different juxtapositions and a lot of different parallels that I think he was making. There's a lot to unpack here. So that's just something that I thought about. It reminded me of, I was looking this up, because I remember in film school watching Le Ballet Mécanique. It was basically this rhythmic cutting of industrial stuff, you know, with lips and humanity, and it sort of comes out like a dance, and it reminded me of that a little bit.
I was sick that day, actually. Yeah. I actually do not remember. That sounds very interesting, though.
Yeah, I think it's so cool, you know, early silent experimental films. I've seen a lot of shorts, but this is one of the few feature length experimental silent films that really stick out in my mind.
Well, hopefully it's the eighth greatest film of all time.
So, in addition to like showing a day in the life of in a Soviet city, it's not entirely, you know, fun and games. There's, I think, he also making some political points as well. I mean, we see the rich and the poor. There's a very clear contrast drawn. The rich people go to health spas, and poor people go to work.
I did notice that.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. I didn't really pick up on what his point was.
Okay.
But that was clearly there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, giving him the benefit of the doubt, he's saying, look how the poor people and the rich people and everybody should be happier.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. But I think, I don't know if he had a specific point that he wanted to make, just that it exists. That was sort of my thought.
I thought about that too, because I wanted to see if I could find like a communist, you know,
right,
feeling in the film. And I didn't really. I just felt like this is how certain people live, you know, in different ways.
Yeah, so. I don't know. I think that was good. Well put.
Well, I thought it was actually very ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say, like, this film, despite the fact it's in black and white and silent, I feel like it's a very modern film, the sense of its sensibilities, the sense of the pacing, the sense of the cuts. In the sense that it's doing something where it's not narrative. I mean, I come from a very narrative background. I came from theater, English. But I'm not used to watching something for a long period of time and not have a narrative to hold on to.
Right.
And it helped my attention. And it's just, that's the power of cinema. And so Vertov was successful in his experiment. I mean, you can see that you don't have to have a story to make something very engaging.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's a relic? Do you appreciate it because of that it's old, or do you feel like it holds up well as a film?
I would say I feel like it holds up well, but I always have to make this distinction, because there are films that you just love. You can watch every day of the week. You can, you know, I say cuddle up with them at night. You know, I was like, oh, I want to watch this movie. I love this movie so much. It's on TV. This is not a film where I feel like, you know, once again, coming from a narrative background, it's not a film that I'd be like, oh, I can't wait to watch this again, you know, this week. I admire it. I do enjoy it. But it, you know, without a very strong emotional connection to it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I feel like it's not a relic. It is and it isn't. I mean, it holds up very well and you can enjoy it for, I feel like, watching something from that time period. But also as a filmmaker, as an inspiring piece of work to get you to, you know, take the camera and do some crazy stuff with it. So I think it works both ways. But is it a film that I, you know, like, you know, I said,
right, what, you're not going to cuddle up with it at night. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that leads me to my final question. Gabe, does it deserve its spot in the top 10 greatest movies of all time?
I did really enjoy watching the film. And for me, what it did is, this was the first film on the list where I really started appreciating the list that we're going through more and more, because I feel like there's a huge component of the list, which is how groundbreaking the films are and how important the films on the list are to filmmaking in general. And so watching this film, you know, kind of, I feel like a light bulb went off and I was like, yes, of course these films are the greatest films of all time. because of the debt that every film that came after them owes to that film. And so, similar to what Jeff was saying, like, I enjoy the film, but I feel as though we are in, I'll say, in an elite class of those who are going to enjoy the film.
Hear that, listeners? You're in an elite class.
Because we appreciate it, because we're, you know, we're aspiring filmmakers, that we enjoy it. Whereas it's not like, hey, you know, Friday night movie night, let's throw in a movie.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree. It deserves to be up there. It's so funny, you know, when they talk about, like, what is, you know, we talked about this last time I was here, like, what is the greatest film of all time? Can there really be a greatest film of all time, you know? And it's hard to rank this film. I mean, is it, you know, it's not narrative, so does a narrative film get placed higher or lower? But as we mentioned, there's a lot of great techniques in it, and it's so inventive that it's like, well, it definitely has to be very high on the list because of all the techniques it developed. So I definitely agree it deserves to be up there. I think we said number 8, you know?
Number 8.
I don't know. I don't know if I would be... What comes before it?
The Searchers.
The Searchers. And what comes after it?
Passion of Joan of Arc, which I'd actually put... I think I'd put Passion of Joan of Arc above that.
That's what I was thinking, too. So I feel like as we continue with this podcast going through the list... I feel like a much better handle on whether or not I feel these films are ranked appropriately.
Right.
Because I feel like I've sort of figured out and sort of bought in to what this list is trying to do.
Right.
And that's immediately what I thought, too. I thought, like, oh, great, this totally deserves to be in the top 10. Like, but is it better than Joan of Arc?
Right.
Like,
yeah. That's, Well, it definitely deserves to be up there. Right. What ranking? I don't know. But definitely up there.
All right. Well, I guess stay tuned next week to find out if Joan of Arc is indeed should indeed be higher. As far as this one goes, I think it is important to have an experimental documentary of this ilk. I think I'm glad that it is represented on the list and in the top 10. It's time for our next topic. Because Man with a Movie Camera is our first documentary on the Sight and Sound list, we thought we'd take this opportunity to talk about our favorite documentaries, what we like about them, and what types of documentaries we enjoy. Before we do that, I'm going to throw a question at you. So for documentaries for a long time have established themselves as higher brow than, say, Hollywood, big mainstream action films, or just generally Hollywood films. Why do you guys think that is? How did it get that reputation?
That documentaries,
yeah. Do you guys feel like they're more highbrow? Like, there's...
I would say this: documentaries have this air of importance to them. You're not going to be entertained. You're going to learn something,
right?
And I think automatically our brains are like, oh, you know what I mean? This isn't going to be. I'm not going to have fun. I'm going to see something and I have to, like, you know, really think about and understand, and it's going to make me, like, you know, be kind of bored, and you know, and I feel like that's unfortunate.
I felt like sort of the opposite. Not that they're more highbrow than Hollywood, but I guess just growing up loving films, I always felt that they were, like, somewhat lower than movies, in the sense that I'm just, well, like you said, that, like, I'm going to have to learn something, you know? So I wasn't ever as interested in them.
Yeah.
And I feel that I've sort of come late to the party in terms of documentaries, and now I've seen several that I enjoy.
So you didn't get a sense that, like, there are film snobs with, like, I'm really into independent foreign films and documentaries. You know, you didn't get that, didn't have that perception.
Yeah, but I don't really like those people.
Okay.
No. I understand what you're saying. Yes, I guess I did. I guess I'm saying in my mind, you know, so whenever I, you know, it was time to watch a movie, I didn't want more school.
Okay. I feel like there has been this shift in recent years where documentaries have become more mainstream.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think the reason for that is because in many ways they've upped their game in terms of sort of the quality of the filmmaking. I think.
Well, I would say that, but I'd also say that I think that technology has become more accessible. And also, so having worked with film and having worked with digital technology, I mean, you can shoot just hours and hours, and not, it doesn't be, it's not as expensive as doing a film documentary. You know, right. You can just have a memory card and you can put all that in your computer. So I feel like you can do very compelling documentaries now and not, you know, spend a fortune on it.
Sure.
And so, but yeah, I like the fact that documentaries are becoming more and more prevalent now because it's nice to see. I mean,
tell me if you buy this. I think that the rise in popularity of reality television has also made documentaries seem more palatable.
Well, maybe. I don't know.
I hope not.
Really?
I think is what I would say. I hope that is not the cause, because when you watch most reality television, it's really bad, you know, and it's really not good for society.
Well, let's talk about that. What distinguishes, say, Grizzly Man versus Man versus Wild or something like that?
I guess I would say perhaps story. Grizzly Man is telling a story, whereas Man versus Wild is presenting a scenario. So something that I think is prevalent in good documentaries is still a story arc.
Mm-hmm.
And something that is not present on reality television shows.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. I don't necessarily agree that a good documentary needs a story. I mean, Man with a Movie Camera, for instance. But some of my favorite documentaries are just the kind of cinema verite, fly on the wall style, where you're just kind of watching people do their thing. So one of my favorite documentaries is Grey Gardens.
Okay.
It's just watching the Edies, Big Edie, Little Edie, and we are watching them in their dilapidated mansion, and we're watching them go about their lives and watching how they live in this squalor, and we're watching them interact with each other, and it's fascinating. So that to me is sort of one example of a kind of documentary that style that I enjoy.
I see what you're saying. I would say that there is a narrative, though, I feel like, in that film. I mean, there's an arc, almost an arc to it. You see, like, you know, they're watching home movies and you see them arguing. So I guess I know what you're saying. I would say that there's more narrative in place, perhaps, for me.
I mean, I think there is. There's a story there, but I don't think it's a narrative. I don't think it's like a linear story. I think it is in showing them interacting and showing how they live their lives. I think it is telling at least a part of their story.
Yes. So, yeah. But I would just say that I feel there's definitely an organization there, and you do get to know them over the course. But I don't want to say what's experiment. I don't think it's really experimental, but it's definitely not like a three act structure
right,
to it. You know?
Right. So. Right. Yeah.
Did you see?
No, I haven't seen that.
Okay. Check out Grey Gardens. I have a soft spot for crazy old ladies, and these are two crazy old ladies. It's basically a couple of relatives of Jackie Kennedy. Like I said, they live in this mansion called Grey Gardens, and it's sad, but it's also kind of funny. And it's just, they have these very unique personalities, and
very lovable, actually.
Yeah, they're pretty, they are, especially Little Edie. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, so without further ado, I mean, what are some examples of documentaries that you guys like? Gabe, how about we start with you?
I really enjoy Jiro Dreams of Sushi.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I that's like really fascinating to watch, and I feel what makes it so fascinating is learning his story and seeing how he goes about his business. You know, it's about an old Japanese guy that runs a little sushi shop in a train terminal in Japan, in Tokyo, I think, and how he practices his craft and hands it on to his children.
And awesome food porn, for those of you who are into that.
This is a family show.
I was going to mention anything by Errol Morris, I think, is fantastic. But the one that I remember seeing that really touched, I felt like a nerve inside me, was The Thin Blue Line. Mm. And what I felt was, it's funny, because I looked it up recently because I wanted to make sure I got one that I thought was very inspiring. They called it a film noir documentary. Mm. And it's interesting that because he adopted techniques that use, like I said, film noir, like there's not like a recreation of something or like a sort of subtle, a very subtle cue about what's going to happen next. And I feel like that really influenced a lot of news programs.
All the elements from that movie have since been incorporated in television. Like that, it could be an episode of 48 Hours.
But anything by Errol Morris, I think, is The Fog of War is brilliant. So, and right, I just had a movie come out now, which I haven't seen. But
yeah. Do you want to describe his style or Errol Morris's style?
It's interesting because there's a style called Talking Head, and it's just basically a series of interviews. And he has that in The Thin Blue Line, but it's also intercut with footage of what happened, like the news footage of what happened and recreations of the event with actors portraying what was going on and like different perspectives of that event. And I feel like those elements elevate it into not just being a fact-based documentary, but also, dare I say, entertaining. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, I was like, oh, okay, so that's interesting. You know, I mean, it's almost like adopting the style that's in Rashomon, where you see like different points of view. And I feel like he married that, the talking head style with the film noir style with a recreation. And it comes together so well.
It's really interesting that you bring up the concept of entertaining. And I think that, as you pointed out, Pauline, that in the past few years, it seems as though there's a renaissance, if you will, of documentary. And I feel like we've even seen that bleed over into narrative films with films like Captain Phillips and Argo, Black Hawk Down, like all these films that I wonder ultimately how good they are for society, because now I feel like people are getting their history, air quotes, from I feel like people are getting their history from these really, at the end of the day, fictitious films.
Right.
So they may be based on reality, based on the true story of Captain Phillips, but they're still just fictitious narrative films.
Right.
And so I wonder if society at large would have been better served by, you know, like a kick-ass documentary about Captain Phillips.
Well, it's interesting, you know? Because I rewatched The Thin Blue Line recently, and it struck me that we do get to hear lots of different points of views, but the film ultimately really wants us to believe that the guy whose name I'm forgetting is innocent, but that we ultimately weren't on the jury. We have no way of knowing anything for sure. So I always feel like it's important to question the motives of a documentary as well.
That's true. And that's a good point, because the moment that someone puts the pen to paper, no matter who it is, they're biased. I think you're absolutely right. That needs to be taken into consideration.
I wanted to talk about mockumentaries. I feel like they serve an important function because they do call attention to the tropes and the organizations of documentaries. And they sort of, you know, we take for granted it's a documentary. Of course it's real. But, you know, it can just as easily be parodied.
That's the thing. I think that the mockumentaries are incredible. I love them.
Yeah.
But I think that's the value of them is that they can be like, hey, guys, lighten up.
Yeah.
You know, just
Death row.
Just take it easy.
I definitely think it's great that mockumentaries have come so in the public conscious that now we have TV shows that, you know, obviously use them. So maybe that'll make them more inclined to watch documentaries. I hope, you know. One thing I did want to bring up, it always seemed the documentaries I saw, they made a point and they always try to make you see the other side. Mm-hmm. And there are documentaries that don't have that. There are documentaries that are less obviously one-sided. We'll name names.
You can name names.
Well, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Michael Moore, who I do appreciate his, and I do appreciate his documentaries. But he has a very specific point with his films. And I wonder, and this goes back to talking about what the author's intent is and their bias. Are we responsible for always giving every point of view possible in documentary? Or are we more is it more important for us to make that point very clear with all the factual evidence as more of an essay why this should be like this? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I'm curious because I feel like there's some documentarians are gathering information about a source and want to get multiple points of view. And then some people are looking for just making a point and is, you know, making following through with that point.
Well, that's a really interesting point. The problem with like muckraking documentaries is that they won't reach as wide an audience. So I think there is a place for documentaries to try to be persuasive. You know, like hey, let's make a documentary about, you know, the plight of children in Africa. So it is important to try to make that point. But when you get too one-sided in your documentary, I think you stunt the reach of your documentary. So you end up with these documentaries that the majority of your fan base is going, you're going to be preaching to the choir.
In a lot of ways, the essay type or the muckraking form of documentary can be really effective. Like Blackfish came out in 2013, I believe. And because of that, you know, SeaWorld is going to have to implement policy changes. And Super Size Me came out, I don't remember which year, and suddenly there's no more Super Size at McDonald's. So it can have a very real impact on the real world, and I think that's the best way to do it. I think the problem comes when you get someone like Michael Moore, who puts himself in the center of the documentary, and he becomes a really inflammatory figure. And so people who are not inclined to agree with him are not going to be inclined to see his views, regardless of whatever his points are, you know.
I was going to mention the other documentary style that I really enjoy, and you touched upon it with Greg Arden's, just that fly on the wall style. But this is more narrative for me. Hoop Dreams, 1994, I think is an incredible film. There were two students in the film. We see their lives, and you see them going off for the NBA and trying to be in the basketball industry.
That's industry. Probably what it is. Yeah.
But they're trying, and you can see the struggles they go through, and you know the academic struggles they go through, and just you know getting scouts and being recruited and everything. And it's fascinating. It's just fascinating. You feel like you live with these two students, and I feel like that's something that documentaries can do that films really can't. I mean, you can't grow up with somebody, technically. I mean, you see them get older, and he spent about 4 years with them, just watching them grow up. And I love that style of documentary as well, because I feel like, I mean, one of the things that we can't really do is we can't actually live someone else's life. But with film, we can actually feel like we are. And that's something that I just really appreciate about that film.
Very good.
Yeah.
That's a classic. Yeah. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention Hoop Dreams.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about found footage documentaries is a style of documentary that I really enjoy. One example where I think it's used really effectively is a movie called Everything is Going Fine, directed by Steven Soderbergh. It's about Spalding Gray. And Spalding Gray is basically a storyteller. He did some acting, but he was primarily known as someone who would get up in front of people and tell stories. And basically, Steven Soderbergh pieced together different footage of Spalding Gray telling these stories and was able to compile basically an autobiographical documentary where Spalding Gray walks us through his whole life. And I think it's fascinating, one, because Spalding Gray is an amazing storyteller, and also he's led an amazing life. So that's one I really want to recommend. But Gabe, did you have another one?
Yes. It is Ken Burns, Civil War.
All right, Ken Burns. Somebody's got to mention Ken Burns.
Well, he's just like a master of his craft, and he does what he does, and he does it really, really well.
Yeah.
And it's not like a, you know, Friday night film, you know, but it's just so informative. And it's like, it's sort of like easy listening jazz.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the perfect comparison, I think.
It's just... Nobody hates like it. Nobody hates it. You know, and his documentaries are just so informative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so you get something that you have an interest in, and just let him take you away.
Yeah, I'm not such a huge Ken Burns fan, mostly because I feel like he takes a subject like the Civil War or you know, jazz, and it's like, this is going to be the definitive documentary about the Civil War. Well, you know, and it's like that particular Ken Burns effect. I feel like...
I would say, like, maybe that's the marketing. I don't know if he himself probably... but...
Yeah.
The man's good at what he does. I give him that.
Can't argue with that. Yeah. You know, like, he has that particular style, and it is like the smooth jazz of the documentary. I love that. So, I guess I'll close it out. I feel like I'd be remiss if we didn't mention Orson Welles, because he must be mentioned on every podcast. It's a rule. One of Orson Welles' last films is called F for Fake, and it's a documentary, but it's kind of more of an essay. And he takes us, initially it starts off, we think it's going to be a documentary about this art forger, Elmer Dehori. I think that's how you pronounce it. Amir? But, so we think it's going to be about this particular art forger, but then Orson Welles takes it in a different direction and explores the nature of authorship and whether it's important if something is genuine. Just so we meet our quota, Orson Welles, F for Fake. It's time again for our final segment. Let's end this thing on a positive note. Gabe, what's one piece of art, music, film, media, etc., that you've recently consumed to which you would like to give a solid thumbs up?
I would like to give a solid thumbs up to a young director, Jeff Nichols.
Okay.
He directed Mud and Take Shelter and Shotgun Stories. And it's not... I really enjoy his films. And it's not that I think they're these absolute masterpieces, but it's that I really wish I could be doing what he's doing. And that I like sort of am currently aspiring to be him. He has, I don't know to what extent, but he gets Final Cut on his films. They're fairly low budget, and he writes and directs all of them. And it's more of just like, hey, thumbs up, man. Like, good job.
All right.
You know, that's something that I wish I could, that I want to be doing. And so he's kind of like forging the way.
All right. You've got a new hero. That's a really good note of positivity.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. All right, Jeff.
All right. Well, I actually was thinking about new forms of media that could relate into documentary style. And I have to say, I didn't think I was going to like this, but I really do feel that this app, Vine, is actually a very, very interesting way of self-expression. And it's a definitely interesting way of anyone can pick up this, you know, pick up a camera, film something for 7 seconds and become endlessly fascinating. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have their whole channels linked to it. And I've watched like an hour's worth, and it goes by so fast. Obviously 7 seconds, they can do stop motion. They can do like any sort of matrix. They can do like some people use it as a platform for their getting out there acting. And it's just interesting to me because you can see people from all over the world actually just doing something, and in 7 seconds they can capture a moment so beautifully. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I just love seeing someone trying to share a moment of their lives with an audience, you know.
All right, well, we'll have to link that in the show page.
There you go.
All right, mine is a documentary it's sort of a documentary. So in preparation for this podcast, I've been watching, sort of binge watching a bunch of documentaries. And one of them is...
Sounds like a party.
Some of us know how to have a fun Saturday night, right? One of the documentaries I watched is The Punk Singer. It's a film about Kathleen Hanna. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Kathleen Hanna, she was one of the founders of the Riot Girl movement. It started in the Pacific Northwest, early 90s, and she was the lead singer of a couple bands, Bikini Kill and La Tigra. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend this film to people who aren't already fans of those bands. However, this The documentary inspired me to go back and listen to some of my old Bikini Kill records. And I'm here to say, for those of you who have some righteous anger that they need to unleash, I'm going to heartily recommend they listen to some Bikini Kill. Yes. I'm looking at you, Gabe.
Okay. This is supposed to be a note of positivity, and you are encouraging violence.
Hurting is going on. It's a way for us to get together.
And kill some bikinis.
They got it coming. Let's be real.
Whoa.
Bikini Kill.
I just don't feel positive now.
Listen, there's a lot of anger in the world, but Kathleen Hanna did something constructive about it.
I just want you to know that Pauline is making
a hand.
What is this hand gesture?
What is this? This beak gesture?
Yeah.
The voila gesture.
Yeah. Like Italian.
Yeah. This is the international symbol for passion, is the symbol I'm making.
Okay. Also, just Google that.
Yeah, exactly.
Or don't. I don't know.
Also, another thing I learned in this documentary is that Kathleen Hanna is married to Adam Horowitz of the Beastie Boys. And before he was in the Beastie Boys, he was in a band called The Young and the Useless, which is the greatest name for a punk band ever. And how The Young and the Useless didn't become world famous, I guess we'll never know. I don't understand that. They got everything going for them.
Aren't there a couple bands now? There's a band called, like, The Naked and Famous. And I feel like there's The Young and the Restless was a soap opera.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing. Like, there's nothing more punk rock than a 90-year-old television show. I think that's awesome. Anyway, so that was my note of positivity.
I feel very confused by all of your notes of positivity.
Really? You don't think that's the greatest punk name ever? The Young and the Useless?
I think the joy that you're showing us is a note of positivity.
Okay, so good. I got a lot of pleasure out of it. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. We'll have links on the show page for a bunch of the things we discussed on the podcast. So, listeners, what's your favorite documentary? Make sure to answer on our show page, flickswise.com, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page. On the next show, we're going to talk about Carl Dreyer's The Passion of Joan of Arc. So looking forward to that. Meanwhile, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Gabe, glad to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
All right. Dos vidania.